as we know, Mishpatim is chock full of so many concepts. It's one of the few parshios where the name really seems to describe in detail its content. There certainly are many, many Mishpatim in this parsha, and there are many dinim of all types, and they come in rapid-fire progression. So even in this really brief aliyah that we have, we could spend many hours talking about it if we had many hours to do it. But there are many, many concepts just in the few sukkim that make up the fourth aliyah, and we'll do the best we can to try to get some kind of a picture of what's described there. So the first word of the aliyah, it's actually a machlokes, whether that word is kodesh or chol. So is this word meant to refer to God, or as we sometimes find in Talmudic sources, that in the Torah, that this word is understood to mean Dayanim. So the whole pasuk, which reads Elohim lo sekalel v'nasi v'amcha lo sa'or, that you should not curse. Who should you not curse? So either it's a reference to the Ribono Shalom, or it's a reference to a Dayan. So this is a machlokas in the Chazal, machlokas in the Chilta, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and that's a machlokas in the Aleph. And then later, it's a machlokas among the Rishonim as to what is the main interpretation. And the Rambam and the Ramban understand that it includes both, that the Pasuk is expansive, and that the idea of Elohim is really a reference to God, but we also have the notion that it includes the Dayanim who act to help bring about God's truth, so therefore it's all one idea, but it includes cursing out both God and the Dayanim as well. So that being the case, there's also a discussion of what is considered a klala. How exactly do we understand the meaning of the word klala? So some understand it to come from a language of chisaron, that there's something missing, that you curse somebody that they should lose something, which is the opposite of the idea of bracha. Bracha is riboy, and klala is deficiency. Or others understand that it comes from the language to mean light, and therefore when you're makabel somebody, you're treating them in a disrespectful way. So to that extent, it could be that a bizayin is included in this iser. But lemaisa, one's only actually chayiv if they actually curse someone, which means, not profanity, though we talk about it today, but literally to curse someone, which is, again, the opposite of a bracha, to wish them ill, to declare that somebody should have some kind of tzar. That's the definition of a klala, practically speaking, and that's prohibited. So this, as far as where it's placed in the Torah, so it comes after the previous aliyah, which talks about the obligation to return hamashkon, when a person needs a loan, and he borrows something, and he has to provide some collateral for it, so we have to give it back to him when he needs it. So is there some kind of a progression here, going right from that din, the end of the last aliyah, to this din? So Mefarshim suggests that maybe there is a flow here, that it could be that maybe the lender indeed won't give it back, and therefore the borrower will get upset at the whole situation, and he'll want to curse the judge who maybe was involved and said that he has to provide the collateral in the first place. So maybe that's going to be caused by that situation, or if we assume that he's referring to God, so maybe he'll rail against heaven, because why was he made poor? If he were a rich man, would that ruin anything? So if that's the idea, so then maybe the circumstance is going to bring that about. Or maybe going back to the notion that it's a judge, so maybe there's going to be a dispute between the lender and the borrower, and they're going to end up in front of a dayan, and they're going to be upset with the ruling, as people tend to be. So therefore, maybe there is this possibility that we have to worry about cursing out the judge. So in general, the idea, if we're assuming it does refer to Dayanim, so why specifically do you have an issue here to curse Dayanim, as opposed to anybody else? So some Rishonim understand Dibur HaKasuv Behove, that in general the Torah sometimes uses the most likely scenario, but doesn't mean to say that it refers to only that scenario. So we just gave some reasons why somebody might be cursing out a dayan, so maybe that's just one of the most likely possibilities, and therefore that's what the Torah describes. But also, very pointedly, presumably it comes to represent the system and the authority figures, and the notion that there is a need to accept such decisions that come from authority figures, and not create a undermining of the system that's going to come from directing your animosity at the dayan and getting upset at him and cursing him out. All of that will lead to a collapse of respect for the system, and that might be what's referenced here. Hi.
So I kind of have two ideas with that, and they both connect to the fact that dayanim might kind of be a stand-in. maybe we forgot or just the halakhic system as a whole. And then can we say that maybe on one hand, it's if you're gonna it's kind of a kal vachomer that you shouldn't curse out judges who hand down decisions that will actually affect your life, as opposed to everyone else, who we assume that Hashem is really in control of your life, so other people you might curse out really aren't in control, but the Dayan actually makes a decision, and him who you shouldn't curse out, who actually makes a decision, you shouldn't curse out. And also just because they're kind of like a stand-in for Hashem, where Rabbi just said with like the
reminding
system.
It represents the whole system, and it's also, it flows into the next idea also, because then the Torah also talks about a Nasi, the Nasi v'am chalos sa'or. So who's that referring to? So according to most Rishonim, that's referring to the king, the Melech. The Rambam says it also includes the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. But here also it's interesting. So why specifically the Nasi, or the king, why is he involved? So here, this is probably a Musar Haskel we can all take. I certainly could take this Musar Haskel. But if we think about the nature of how we talk about politics in America, or anywhere else, or Israel, or anywhere. So there's perhaps some kind of a message here. So two of the ideas that you find in the Rishonim, one is that the Sforno writes that there's a specific reference here to cursing the king, because what's bad for the king is probably bad for the country as a whole. So certainly in America with our political adversarial system, so it's easy to lose track of that and criticize whoever is in power and to wish them ill, so to speak, in terms of their agenda, and to lose sight of the fact that that means that the country is going to be affected by that. But also, the way the Sefer HaChinuch says it is perhaps particularly relevant to us, to all of us, and really even especially in a democratic system. So it's interesting, all the more so, if it's really a reference to a king, but the message, the way the HaChinuch understands it, is even more relevant to those who function in a democracy. And Sefer HaChinuch has an interesting drasha there, where he says that, practically speaking, society always needs a leader. We can't function without some kind of a governmental head. So we're going to have to get together and appoint somebody to be in charge. And it's always going to mean that some people aren't going to be happy with some things, that you're going to have some kind of a system to decide what's going to prevail and how are you going to make policies. And there's going to be a trade-off of what people are happy about and what they're less happy about. And therefore, since that's the basic understanding, then in order to function, you're going to have to select somebody and you're going to have to let the majority rule and you're going to have to work under a system where not everybody's happy all the time. So it doesn't make sense to be cursing out the king, because you have to understand that that's the system. There's going to be parts of it you're not going to like, and there's going to be parts of it that you're really going to be upset about. But the only way that society can function is if you have some kind of a organized approach, and therefore it doesn't make sense to get upset about the bad things, because that's a necessary part of how the system works. So both of those interpretations probably have a lot of message for us when we talk about politics, and probably not going to change anything, but something to think about. So others understand also that this is another example of Dibur HaKasuv Behova, that maybe again, it's not about cursing the king specifically, it's about cursing people, but again, who do we know is most likely to get criticized by people? So the political leader is the most likely choice. So maybe that's why the Torah refers to that. In Sefer Vayikra, we're going to have again Lo Sakal Cheirish. So some of the Mefarshim suggest that it's there to now have a whole spectrum. So from the Cheirish to the king, we basically understand that the whole world is subject to this idea, and we shouldn't be Mekalo anybody. It's interesting because the reference to Cheresh doesn't necessarily come to tell us that somebody who's in a lower strata is a lower stratus of society, but rather it comes to say that even somebody who's not able to hear you, and you might think that the only issur of being mekalel somebody is because they're going to be aggravated when they hear what you're saying. So maybe if the person can't hear you, so then maybe it's okay. So maybe that's the message. So there you have to then consider. So if there's really a contrast here, two different ends of the spectrum, as far as the king and the cheresh, that's maybe something to think about. The next pasuk is a little hard to translate. There are a lot of things actually in this Aliyah that are a little hard to translate. But it says, "M'le'ascha v'demacha lo sacher." So what does that mean? So the words, it's not clear how the words mean what they're interpreted as. As Rashi notes, it seems like this is a reference to Bikurim and Truma, but this is not really clear where the language comes from. Many Rishonim understand that these are somehow words that represent fruits and that connect to the obligation that comes on fruits, whether it's Meiser or Bikurim. truma or other kinds of obligations, but we're not supposed to delay them. We're supposed to turn them over promptly. And the Sefer Paris Yosef Acharis, she quotes from the Zayas Ra'anan that this is a reference both to the nedarim that one makes during good times, that the language of mala is meant to convey times when you are full and abundant, and timacha represents times from dimua as a language of confusion. So the good times and the bad times sometimes move you to make commitments. And from all those times, one should make sure to act promptly and to turn it over and to make good on these commitments. But again, there are many different interpretations. The pasuk really is not so obvious how it means one thing or the other. In fact, in the Hadar Zakenim, he understands it to connect more to the second part of the pasuk in a more direct way, because he understands it to mean don't delay getting married and having children. One should have somehow understand that Malay is a reference to women, a reference somehow to having children. So one should not delay marriage and children. And then that fits with the rest of the pasuk, at least, even if it's the unlikely interpretation compared to what most other mefarshim say. But b'chor banecha titengli. So then we have the din of pidgin aben, or the din of the concept of b'chor, that he should be, so to speak, turned over to God. And Balaturim understands that to mean not delaying that right after day 30. So in general, when it comes to Pidgin HaBen, so we understand really that it's not like a bris milah when you have an obligation specifically on the eighth day. We do Pidgin HaBen right after it turns 30 days old, but it's really because of Zrizus, because technically the mitzvah applies its whole life, but we're not going to delay. So we do it as soon as it becomes relevant. And the Magen Avraham understands there's actually a notion of Baal Ta'acher here. We don't want to delay as far as the concept that we find by Nedarim and Tzedakah, while others understand differently that it's not any specific Isser, but that there is an issue of Zrizim Makdim in the Mitzvahs. But others see it as something more than that. The Lavush understood that there is something that one violates if you wait. And the Kolbo went as far as to say you'd have to add a Chomesh, which would get expensive. And so this perhaps all coming from this pasuk specifically, telling us that not only do we have the mitzvah, but we shouldn't delay. We should do it promptly. So that's something that has some practical implications. There were some who suggested that maybe until there's a pidgin aben, that's usher to get hana from the baby. Now, it's a good question what that would mean practically. We don't really assume like that. But it reflects the idea that there's something that's waiting, that it's not just a question of the mitzvah and do it at the first opportunity, but there's something similar perhaps to a reilus, to an uncircumcised baby. Now, you have this notion as well that it needs to be taken care of, it needs to be attended to, and that's the obligation that emerges from here, to make sure to take care of it. It's interesting in general because we don't find that we treat pidgin aben the same way as a bris milah. When it comes to bris milah, it's normally in the morning because of Zrizim Makdim and Mitzvos. When it comes to pidgin aben, so they are often in the afternoon. So there are different reasons why that could be. But the Stechemer got very upset about this. He thought that was a violation of the notion of Zrizim Makdim and Mitzvos. I remember discussing this once with Rav Schechter, where he thought that the trade-off was that we're worried we're not going to get a crowd, and we have a hiddur of Rovam Hadras Melach also, that we should do mitzvos in front of a large zibur. So even though it would be more of a zrizus to do it earlier, but there's more of a crowd for Rovam Hadras Melach to do it later. But if that's the case, so then it's interesting, so why don't you have the same logic by a bris milah? So we should also make a bris milah later in the day to get a bigger crowd. Now, the truth is, we do compromise a little bit, because really, if you wanted to have Zrizos in the fullest sense, we should do the bris at the very, very beginning of the day, the first moment, right after the Vasikin minyan. So they usually don't do it that early, necessarily. So there's a little bit of a concession to the Rovam Hadras Melach. But it could also be that when it comes to a bris milah, so there is, because the mitzvah is specifically on the eighth day, so that creates a greater urgency. And when it comes to pidgin aben, the mitzvah is not tied into a specific day. It only becomes applicable from that time, ben chodesh tipadeh. So we still want to get it early, but we're not risking the same possible loss. If you're going to do a bris in the afternoon, and then it gets late, and the mole's stuck in traffic, and then it's shkia, so then you lose the eighth day. When it comes to pidgin aben, you don't have that same dynamic there. So maybe we're a little more machmir about doing the bris early as opposed to when it comes to a pidgin aben. But this pasuk is indicating that pidgin aben, we have to also be careful not to delay, and we should get to it promptly. All right.
Pidgin aben at night?
So that's a whole question. There's a minig not to do it at night, but that's doesn't affect the kiyum hamitzvah. But so, and even if you wanted to say you're not going to do it at night at all, so okay, you do it the next day. It's not fundamentally different. A bris, we mamish can't do it at night. But not only that, but then you lose the eighth day. So it's a fundamental hefset there. So that concept doesn't apply to pidgin aben. So this one possible explanation. The Ramban has a comment over here about all these dinim as we're seeing. So they're all referred to, especially in this past pasuk, in somewhat of a abstract kind of way. And he understands that they're going to be spelled out later. This is not really what the Torah is telling us, these details, but it's all to be included in the bris. So what we're reading about here in Parshas Mishpatim, so we want to be reminded that this is a part of the bris that we're taking on, so therefore the psukim are alluding to these mitzvos now, even though it's not really their home, it's not really where we're going to find out all the details. So the next pasuk, after following up on this idea of the b'chor of a human, so the next pasuk talks about animals, kim ta'asel l'shorecha l'sanecha shivas yom yai mimo b'yom hashmini titnali. So also we have a bechor of an animal, so it should be with its mother for 7 days, and then after that it should be given over. Now here, that's actually not practically what happens. The Mishnah says in Bechorus and Daf Chavav that Chazal had understood that the animal should stay with the original owner longer, because they should take care of it, let it grow a little bit before turning it over to the kohen. So for a smaller animal it's 30 days, and for a larger animal it's 50 days. An interesting question whether this is a different din or this is somehow an interpretation of what the pasuk is telling us. But practically speaking, that's what Chazal said to do. But it sounds like from this pasuk saying that on day 8 it's eligible, that theoretically it could be brought after the 8th day. Before the 8th day it wouldn't be, but from the 8th day on it's theoretically offerable. But in practice, the Yisrael is told take care of it for longer before turning it over to the Kohen. So this next pasuk is also particularly interesting, and there's a lot to say about this. V'anshe kodesh tiyun li, uvaser besada treifa lo sochelu l'kelev tashlifan oso. So here we have a couple of ideas, not clear how they're all related. So it says that we should not eat vaser treifa, and instead we should feed it to the dog. And the pasuk starts off by saying Anshei Kodesh. So what's the relevance of Anshei Kodesh to those din? So the Mefarshim have different interpretations as to what the message is. Some say that it's telling us why we shouldn't eat treif, because we're Kodesh and we should be separate from that. Others understand it as kind of a havtacha, that if you stay away from treif, you will become holy. And some see it as its own mitzvah completely, that it's just telling us before other things that you should be Kodesh. There's an interesting interpretation in the Zohar that says that this message telling us that because we're holy people, so we should treat each other in a holy fashion, and we shouldn't make up not nice nicknames for other people. So this actually later spoke a little bit about this last night. There's an issur of Mechane Shemra L'Chaveiro that Mara talks about in Bav Metzia, which is understood to be a detail of Onos Devarim, even though the Gemara says that there's a prohibition of Halbanus Pnei Chaveiro Baravim, and then on top of that, there's another prohibition of giving somebody a bad nickname, which is considered separately, the Gemara says, because even though you're embarrassing people when you give them a bad nickname, but eventually the embarrassment wears off, but it's still also to continue to use this bad nickname. And Rashi says, because you're trying to embarrass the person. I think it could also be because you're alienating a person from themselves. You're taking away their connection to their own identity, which is very anxiety-provoking and causes real bad feelings. So there's a separate isser to call somebody by a negative nickname. So the Zohar happens to connect to this pasuk, we're Anshei Kodesh, so that's not the way we treat each other. That's not the way we talk. But after that, the pasuk tells us, perhaps connected to that, perhaps not, that we're not supposed to eat a treifa. So it's interesting that we use treif nowadays to refer to anything that's not kosher, or if we treif up the kitchen because you mixed meat and milk. But the word treifa is actually more limited than that, well, even though here it's somewhat of a machlokus what it means. So more specifically, when we talk about a treifa, we mean an animal that's different than a behemoth tmeya, which is an animal that's just not kosher at all, like a pig. And it's different than an avela, which would mean a kosher animal that wasn't shechted properly. It means an animal that is sick and that will die on its own. So there's its own issur to eat it. So that's in general what we mean when we say treifa, even though we use the word more expansively. So here also, it's not 100% clear. It sounds like that's what it means. It means an animal that's sick. Some of the Mefarshim understand it differently. But what also confuses things a little bit is because this relationship, Anshei Kodesh. So what is the Kedusha specifically in avoiding treifa out of all the kashrus possibilities? You could say, okay, I understand avoiding certain types of animals is a certain discipline, and avoiding a nevela is part of the obligation of shechita. And if we understand that shechita is about rachmanis and it's about being careful the way you treat the animal, so all of those are actually more easily understood. Treifa is among the kashrus rules, even though kashrus in general perhaps is treated as a chok. But those other concepts are a little easier to relate to as a notion of Kedusha. How is treifa really in that category? It's a little more difficult, especially because Rav Hirsch understands that the reason the Torah is emphasizing Kedusha here is a way of saying that kashrus isn't only about health, it's about holiness, it's not tied down to biological realities. But it happens to be that some of the Mefarshim do think that that's what treifa specifically is about, that there must be some kind of harm that comes from eating an animal that's sick. Maybe it's poisonous on some level. So there was a discussion in general. The Rambam or Nevuchim talks about the question of whether rules and kashrus had any connection to health. So it happens to be in this pasuk, it's a little more difficult because out of all the dinim in kashrus, treifa maybe is most likely to have some health connection, and that's a little counter to what Rav Hirsch is saying, that the reference to Kedusha is in order to make the point that it's not about that. But again, there is a possibility that this is a reference to a broader concept of what we're not supposed to eat. The idea that there's something unhealthy about it, so Ibn Ezra comments that that's why the Torah says that you should give it to your dog specifically, not because you don't care about your dog, but it's in contrast with a person. So you shouldn't give it to a non-Jew or to a ger, because that would be damaging. And when it comes to a nevela, we're told that you can sell the nevela to a non-Jew. So Ibn Ezra suggests that the difference is that there we're not assuming that it's dangerous, but if there's a concern that it's dangerous here, so you wouldn't want to give it to a person. In both cases, the reference of telling you should tell it to a non-Jew in the case of a nevela, or feed it to your dog here in the case of the treifa, is a mixed message, or it's a compound message, that is also telling us that there is a heter hana, that the Gemara and Pesachim and elsewhere tries to figure out when the Torah says you're not allowed to eat something. So sometimes it means that there's a broader prohibition, you can't get hana from it at all. You can write a get on it, but you can't get otherwise hana. And others understand, in other cases, it means that it's specifically an Isser Achila, and there's no prohibition of Hana. So in the case of Nevela and Treifa, the Torah is spelling out that there are other things you can do. You can't eat it, but you can make use of it. You can sell it to a non-Jew, you can feed it to a goy, you can feed it to a dog. So there are perhaps other benefits that you can have. Is there a specific reference why it says to feed it to your dog? So there are understandings that Chazal have also, that this is the schar for the dogs. We spoke about a few weeks ago, it was also in Revi'i, about the idea that we're grateful to the dogs in Mitzrayim for not barking during Makas Bechoros. So here, Kadosh Baruch Hu makes sure to pay back every creature and to give it its reward. So we are grateful to the dogs, so we give it its reward, and it gets to eat the treifa that the humans aren't able to eat. And the Mefarshim point out that that notion of emphasizing that Kadosh Baruch Hu is not mekapeh schar kol bria, that God doesn't hold back the reward of any animal, it's so that we should appreciate that here you have animals that are not bali bechira, they can't decide what to do on their own, and yet they're still credited, they're still rewarded for what they do. So it's pretty awe-inspiring to think about that. So we who are bali bechira, and we do have the ability to choose and to decide our behavior, so presumably tzchar ve'onesh for us is much more significant, and that's something to think about. The Avravanel has a comment focusing on this idea of Kedusha and about treifa, that the connection between the two, he has a Musar Shmuz there about hunting, that hunting is not an activity for a nice Jewish boy. That's a notion that's most associated with the tshuva, the Noda Behuda, and the tshuva is in Yerudei and it's in Yud. has a tshuva like that, where he goes through the question of hunting for sport, and he has many reasons why this is not an activity for a nice Jewish boy. It's not going to get you any kosher food that way, so it's not productive, and it's not the right way to treat the animals, and it's not safe. It's dangerous. Sorry?
Dabra Melech cut the throat of the chickens with the arrow.
So, yes, so if you're going to shecht an animal in a way that's kosher, so it's a different story, but to hunt animals for sport, so that's not the proper behavior, and it's dangerous, and it's wasteful, and it's everything that we don't really like. So, it's the behavior of Esav, and it's specifically contrasted with the behavior of Yaakov. So, we're not into hunting for sport. You know, the view that has that in the Tshuva, and the Ramah also references this idea, because the Ramah in Hilchos Shabbos talks about the Malacha of Tzad, and he talks about the fact that if you use hunting dogs, like the people who hunt foxes, they have the dogs that go to chase the foxes, so that the Ramah says if you do that on Shabbos, so that would be Tzad also, using the dog to chase the animal, and then he adds there, and some say it's a problem during the week also, if this kind of behavior is not proper Jewish behavior for a number of reasons, whether it's hunting with dogs or whether it's hunting with rifles in the forest. None of these is going to get you any kosher food or be a proper way to spend your time, and therefore these aren't considered to be good Jewish practices. Hi.
What if you did it as like a business, like you would sell like deer skins and like, you know?
So presumably if it's productive, so then it's a different story. I think the emphasis here is that one's doing this because they enjoy it somehow and they feel that this is a sport. So there are various issues that the Milvi Yehuda points out. So if it's just done for sport, so you're exposing yourself to danger and you're acting in a frivolous way and treating the animals in a way that's not good for them, so there's a lot of things that are not helpful. If you actually make a parnasa from it in a productive way, so then presumably a lot of these things would be secondary to that. But certainly to do it for sport, it's fun, you think that this is a good way to spend your afternoon. So this isn't something that we recommend for Jews or for others. So the next pasuk we really could speak about for many hours. I'll just try to say a little bit about it. There's a tremendous significance in the next pasuk. Lo sisa shema shav, v'alteshes yadcha, im rasha lios eit chamas. So the truth is, let's say the second part first, because it's a lot less to say. We'll focus then on the first part. So the second part of the pasuk says that you shouldn't combine with a rasha to be a false witness. That if you have somebody who's looking to pull off a scam and he needs help and he wants you to testify for him, so certainly you shouldn't do that. As you can understand, Rashi understands that even just joining in with him and even promising you're going to do it is enough. Even before you take a false shvua, you'd be in violation of this pasuk. Some understand it to refer to dayanim, that they shouldn't accept the testimony of false witnesses, which presumably sounds pretty self-evident, but perhaps the thinking might be that you're not going to work hard to really determine whether the witnesses are telling the truth or not, then you'll say, okay, it's their problem. If there's going to be a kilkul hadin here, it'll be because of the witnesses, and I don't have such a responsibility. So the Torah is emphasizing that, no, you do have a achrayus to really be careful and to understand who's telling the truth and who's not. So that's relevant to the first part of the pasuk also. The first part of the pasuk is relevant to all of us. It has tremendous significance. And it is possibly the source for the issur of speaking Lashon Hara. And more likely, as the Gemara says, it is the source for the issur of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. But that really leaves us with a lot to figure out. So just to try to say a few words about this, in terms of the relationship between the two psukim, so the Chazal have a comment that whoever speaks Lashon Hara and Makabal Lashon Hara is Roy Lashlicha L'Klavim. He is worthy of being thrown to the dogs, just like the Treif in the previous pasuk. So that doesn't leave too many of us standing, if that's the case, but it's certainly a powerful warning. But the notion that this pasuk is telling us about a prohibition, let's say first of being Makabal Lashon Hara, is a fascinating idea, because there are a lot of questions that need to be figured out within that concept. So first of all, how do you translate the words in the pasuk? So it's not an easy pasuk to translate. Lo sisa, so you should not lift up, you should not bear, you should not elevate, you should not carry. All of those are possible interpretations here. A shema shav. So what is shema shav? So a shema is a report. What does shav mean? So it's hard to translate, but when push comes to shove, we normally think that it means in other contexts, it means unnecessary. So usually that's what it means when you say shvua shav, the difference between a shvua shav and a shvua sheker. If somebody were to take a shvua, the sky is green, that'd be a shvua sheker. If you take a shvua that the sky is blue, so it's not false, but it's useless. Who needs you to take a shvua that the sky is blue? So that's a shvua shav. So normally we say, lo sisa shem Hashem elokecha l'shav, and we shouldn't take God's name in vain, we shouldn't do things for no purpose. So if that's what it means, it works well, because then it's saying that you should not accept a report that is unnecessary. So that would fit well with our conception of Lashon Hara, that we know that sometimes you do have to accept a report if it's necessary. That if there's going to be harm from your not knowing about it. So if it means unnecessary, so then that fits well. And in fact, Rav Huttner, in his letters printed in the Igros Pachid Yitzchak, so he understood that the source for the concept of Toelas in Lashon Hara is based on this language, that one should not be Makabel Lashon Hara when it's Lashav, but if it's not Lashav, if it's for a purpose, so then that would be a different story. However, what complicates things is that both Rashi and Unklus, if you can do Shnei Mikra Bechle Targum, so you'll see Rashi and Unklus, so they translate Shav here as Sheker. So that makes things harder for a lot of reasons. But among them, so we assume that Lashon Hara contains truth. According to some interpretations, Lashon Hara is specifically true information, as opposed to Motzi Shemra, which is translated as slander, something that's false. I think that interpretation is somewhat oversimplified, because I don't know if there's any real basis to assume that Lashon Hara is purely true information, but certainly it would seem that it includes true information. So if that's the case, that Lashon Hara means saying things that may even be true, but the prohibition to be Makabel Lashon Hara means you shouldn't accept a false report. So how do those two match up? And that's something some of the Mefarshim pick up on. And there's a lot to comment about this. Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva, so he interprets it in a way that involves adding an extra word, that you should not accept as true a report that might be false. So that's more relatable a little bit, that you shouldn't jump to assume something is true if there's a possibility that it isn't. And as others point out, it's hard to translate it literally, because if it just means a false report, so if you know that it's false, why do you have to be told not to accept it? Presumably you're not going to want to accept something that you know to be false. But if it's a suffix false, so then it's easier to understand, and it's easier to relate to also, because very often we hear things which aren't necessarily proven or so based in fact, but we don't want to go through the intellectual energy of reserving judgment on that, so we just take it as true. And according to Rabbeinu Yonah, that's the nature of the Isser. But if we say otherwise, that it relates to how we understand Lashon Hara, so how do you reconcile that issue that Lashon Hara contains truth, even if it's not exclusively true, but it contains truth, and the Pasuk telling us not to be Makabel it, is saying don't be Makabel that which is false. So presumably what it really refers to is the fact that Lashon Hara isn't as true as it seems, and that even maybe if you want to maintain the distinction between Lashon Hara and Motzi Shemra, and say that Motzi Shemra is complete fiction, and it's complete slander that comes out of nowhere, and Lashon Hara is rooted in truth, but it doesn't mean that it's creating a complete true picture, and that when somebody speaks Lashon Hara, there may be facts in what they're saying, but the picture that's coming out is not true. And that could be for any kind of reason, for a number of reasons. It could be because it's incomplete. It could be because it's subjective and it's not really even saying a fact at all. And it could also be that it's because of our failure to really appreciate what's true and what isn't. And we have all kinds of cognitive biases that get in the way, and we think things are true and they're really not true, even if we believe that they're true. And there's a lot to say about this if you want more. It's a book I can tell you to get at the farm sale that goes into more detail about this. Just plugging that for your sake. You understand, right? You know, that's just to help out the farm sale people. So there's a lot to say about this, a lot to say about what not to say. But that goes to the fact that the speaker may think he's saying something true, but really it's highly distanced from the truth. So when we say the Pasuk says Lo Sisa Shem Hashav, meaning don't accept a false report, so that could reflect the fact that even if the speaker thinks what he's saying is true, by the time it reaches the ear of the listener, it's very not true. And if that's perhaps what the pasuk is saying, don't accept the false picture that is coming to you from the Mesaper Lashon Hara. And if that's the case, it's interesting, because the Gemara in Erechin lists the Makaba Lashon Hara as one of the three people who is hurt by Lashon Hara, is killed, the way the Gemara says it. Lashon Hara kills three, and those three are the subject that we understand he's harmed. The speaker, that's a bigger chiddush, that the speaker hurts himself by speaking Lashon Hara. But also, the Makabel, the recipient, is harmed. And that, the Rambam adds on, the Makablo Yoser Min HaOmro. And that somehow the recipient is even worse than the speaker. So that's hard to understand why that should be. Why should it be that it's a bigger problem to be the Makabel? So if we think about what we just said a minute ago, that the speaker thinks he's telling the truth, but really, in actuality, there's a lot in what he's saying that's not true. When it comes to the listener, that's even more the case. And there is a phenomenon that's been documented called the teller-listener extremity effect that reflects this idea that whatever is missing in what the speaker is saying, by the time the listener tries to process it, he's getting even less. He's even farther from the truth. And they talk about certain aspects of how we process information called leveling and sharpening. Leveling is you basically smooth out all the nuances, so everything looks like it's flat. And sharpening is kind of the opposite, that certain points take on greater intensity than they really had. And the listener is really getting a very skewed picture. And I think, again, this is something that's very relatable. We can understand what that's like. You can imagine somebody's telling you a long story, and you don't really have the patience to process all the details accurately, and your reaction is, okay, I get it, he did something bad, whatever it is, and you're not really focusing on the details. So that idea that what comes to the listener is even less true than what the speaker is conveying is something that we really can understand and connect to. So that being the case, it's also very striking, the whole idea that there is a separate iser for Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. You could have thought that I understand I shouldn't be listening to Lashon Hara, but that's kind of like an accessory idea, that the one who's speaking Lashon Hara, he's doing an Aveira, and he wouldn't do it if he didn't have an audience, if he didn't have the encouragement of people listening, so we can understand that it's wrong to listen to Lashon Hara. But the very fact that there's its own pasuk, so that seems to suggest that it's more than just an accessory idea, that it's its own Aveira to be Mekabel Lashon Hara. And in fact, the Gemara even suggests that the Isser of speaking can also be derived from this pasuk, which suggests that it's actually the other way around, that maybe the real Isser is in Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. And the accessory is the speaker. Not that we thought the listener is the accessory and the real criminal was the speaker. Maybe the real Aveira is in being Makabel, and the speaker is the accessory because he gives you what to be Makabel. He causes you to be Makabel with Lashon Hara, and maybe that's really the problem. It's really all in the processing, which is a fascinating idea, but may indeed have some basis here. So it also becomes relevant to understand what is the Isser of Kabbalah Lashon Hara. So how do we define that? So it seems like it's not just listening. Listening does not automatically equate to Kabbalah, even though it's a short jump from listening to accepting, and therefore it would be inadvisable to listen to Lashon Hara if you can avoid it. The Chafetz Chaim thought that maybe there was an Isser of listening, maybe at least an Isser Midrabanan, because the Gemara said in the beginning, Exuvis, Tashning Apasik, and Kiseitze, that your ears have earlobes, so that if you are confronted with something you shouldn't be listening to, you can put your earlobes in your ears to stop it from hearing. So it's not a Drasha Menhatorah, it's an Asmachta, so maybe at least there's an Isser Drabanan to hear Lashon Hara. But he thought also there's an Isser Daraisa, which is based on this Pasik, because this pasuk has another interpretation also. So it's not only about people listening to Lashon Hara, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin applies it also to Dayanim, that when you have a Dayan who's involved in litigation, he's not allowed to listen to ex parte communications. If one of the litigants wants to speak to him and the other litigant isn't there, so the Dayan is not allowed to listen. And that also works with both meanings of the word shav, that if it means unnecessary, so we understand that the Dayan is going to have to process a lot of Lashon Hara when he's sitting in judgment. But if he's not in session, you can't have it going on with only one party there. So then it's a total waste for him to be listening, so maybe that's what it means. But it could also mean Sheker in that context, Because if the Dayan's going to let one party talk, then the other party isn't there, so he's going to say things that aren't true, especially because he's not going to be intimidated. He's not going to be inhibited by the fact that the other party is there to argue. So, therefore, it's going to come out to be sheker. So there's an issur for the Dayan to listen to one party without the other. So there, says the Chafetz Chaim, it's clear that the issur is just on listening. So it could be when it comes to Kabbalah Lashon Hara, there's also an issur just to listen. And others would challenge that and say there's a difference between Dayanim and people in general. When it comes to Dayanim, they have this extra need to be completely impartial, and the very negative effect that's going to come from listening to one party without the other. So that's just about listening. But when it comes to Kabbalah Lashon Hara, it's more than listening. But what is it then, if it's not just listening? So the Chafetz Chaim understood that it means that you can't believe what you're hearing. That even if you have to take action to protect from harm, if something might be dangerous, and the Gemara Maseches Nida in Samach Beis talks about how we fast every year because of a lack of being Mekabel Lashon Hara, so to speak, because Gedalia ben Achikam was tipped off that there was an assassination plot against him and he wasn't Mekabel and he was killed. So we fast every day, the day after Rosh Hashanah, because of that. So we are supposed to factor in when something is dangerous. But the Chafetz Chaim says, beyond that, you're not supposed to believe it. It's not even supposed to believe the dangerous stuff. You have to act to protect yourself, so you have to function as if it's true. But that's different from believing it, which is very striking. But it does sound like that's the pshat in that Gemara. That Gemara over there in Nida has the language that Hai Lishnavisha, after the Kibula lo mebay, lemechosh mebay, that when it comes to Lashon Hara, that even though you're not supposed to be Mekabel, you should be Choshesh. So there's a discussion in the Rishon on what that means to be Choshesh, but that's seemingly what the Chafetz Chaim is saying, that you don't accept it as true, but you work into the consideration the possibility that it's something that you have to worry about. And the Chafetz Chaim then went on to say that you shouldn't accept it as true, not even as a suffix. So that's a question. What does that mean? If it might be true and you're not sure, so isn't that what a suffix is? So that's what Chazanish thought. Chazanish responded to this. He didn't think this was an understandable distinction. And he's quoted as saying, Ein zeh el olamdus. This is just some conceptual chiluk that doesn't have any real meaning. Because if you don't, if you're not sure whether it's true or not, so that is a suffix. So it sounds like what the Chafetz Chaim was trying to say is that even if you're not makabel something fully, but if you treat it as a suffix, there's a stigma that comes with suffix also. So therefore, he's saying that you shouldn't accept it as true, nor should you stigmatize the person who it's being said about. You'll just have to factor in the possibility that you may have to act in a protective fashion. And it's not so hard to accept that that could be true, even though it sounds like it's very difficult to pull off. But Lamashal, let's say I were to say to you, let's say you're about to go into business with somebody, and you have to give him your whole life savings, and you have to decide in the next hour you're going to give him over your whole life savings. So let's say I were to tell you that I'm not sure, but there's a 1 in 3 chance that this guy is a ganav and he's going to run off with all of your life savings. So would you do it? So presumably not. A 1 in 3 chance is way too big of a risk to take, so you'll have to beg off. But if I were to ask you, okay, tell me right now, do you think this guy is a ganav or not? So there's a 2/3 chance that he isn't. So Alpi Rov, he isn't. So these two ideas can coexist, that you can assume somebody is likely to be innocent, and yet also factor in that you're going to protect yourself and not proceed based on the degree of risk that's there. So perhaps that's what the Chafetz Chaim is getting at, and that you can have both at the same time, l'meichosh mibayi, and also don't believe it even as a suffix. Don't stigmatize the person at all. Hi.
So it's interesting, because I actually told you about this case, because I remember the scam call that I got during your class.
Yeah.
So he's like, he's a real guy, he's a Jewish guy, like, I don't think he's religious at all. And the more I looked into it, the more he's like fully a part of like a cult called like Day Life Jesus or something like that. No, the Day Life cult, and he's Day Life Jesus.
Okay, we're going to run out of time for going to the whole
story.
But to be continued, it does happen. Your point is that it does come up, that you have to be choshesh, that there's a real possibility.
Sorry, but we let it spread around, because I'll make the point very fine. So he was in a chat, and I told the guy in the chat to like say, like, if this guy calls you, do not give him money. So
If a person's a threat to others, so then even if you're not sure, but they think there's a strong possibility, so then they have to be aware.
So would you say this guy might be a scammer, or would you say this guy...
Everything's calibrated to the exact facts that you know, but to the degree that it's able to be applied. So that's what you try to convey, that there is a real risk there. So that's how the Chafetz Chaim understood that you shouldn't believe it, even as a safek. And others disagreed with that whole interpretation. They said it can't be there's an issur to believe because HaTorah le'nitlam malachi ashar. So that's one of the themes of the last week's parsha as we discussed. Torah is given to human beings, and if somebody who's always told you the truth tells you a story about somebody, so then you're going to believe it. You're going to accept it as true in your mind. So therefore, they suggest, when Moshe Sternbach has a tshuva like this, and there's some who wrote commentaries on Chafetz Chaim, they wrote similarly, that it must mean that you're not going to treat the person differently based on what you've heard. Again, you'll have to protect yourself if there's some kind of issue, but beyond that, you won't treat them any differently because of what was told to you. So that difference, perhaps you could suggest that the issue, the Chafetz Chaim saying it's about believing, and others saying that it's about behavior, maybe that goes to a chakira one could ask about the nature of the Yisra Lashon Hara. Is Lashon Hara about the mida of being a gossip, in which case you don't want to enable that conversation at all, and you don't even want to partake in it mentally? Or is it about gram hezek, that by talking about somebody, you put them at risk of unwarranted harm, and therefore, as the potential makabel, so your job is to not allow that harm to happen by not acting on it. So maybe that's the difference between the two, and it has more nafkaminas than you might think, because this comes up a lot for people in different situations. There was an interesting tshuva of the tshuva's Tirish V'Yitzar, who had a very interesting scenario. He said, let's say somebody were to burst into this room right now and to go right over to this person sitting in front of me and saying, I have this very juicy Lashon Hara about Sam Cohen, so I have to tell it to you right now. So he doesn't realize that he's talking to Sam Cohen. So Sam has a choice. What's he going to do? He really has three choices. He could say, I'm Sam Cohen. So he's not going to do that because he's too much of a tzaddik. So he has two other choices. So one choice he has is he could say, I don't want to hear Lashon Hara. How common is it that somebody's actually telling you in advance that they're going to speak Lashon Hara? It's a good opportunity to say, don't tell me. But he says there's another possibility that maybe he might think that since it's about him, so there's no harm in letting him say it. And maybe there's a bracha, because the Gemara in the Masechta, actually, Gemara in Gittin says that Kadosh Baruch Hu's good list, O Havav, Kesesh, Hashemesh, Bivaraso, Chazal, interpreting the Pasuk, Hanelavim, Vienim Olvim, Shom, Lecherpasim, Vienim Meshivim, that if somebody insults you and you don't feel like you have to respond, that's a great source of bracha. So perhaps here's a good opportunity, so he'll listen to this Lashon Hara, and it won't harm anyone else because it's about him, and he'll get the bracha of Nelavim, Vienim Olvim. So this is probably totally on those two tzadim, that if he is or is, that it's the midah of Lashon Hara, so then he shouldn't let the speaker indulge that midah at all. But if it's about causing potential hezek, so then maybe he's on fair ground to say, in this case, there isn't going to be any hezek that could actually come from it. Maybe it's a source of bracha. So this could actually come up with people more commonly than you think, because for people who have secret identities, this becomes a very practical issue, because sometimes a superhero is going to get people complaining about him and not knowing that that's the guy. So the suffix of the Tirish V'Yitzar could be very relevant to him, and it should be more publicized for the superhero community. But in any event, so there's a lot more to say about this, but it's a lot more Lashon Hara to say always, but just to add one more note, so this machlokas between the Chafetz Chaim and others, probably the truth is somewhere in the middle, that those who said that it's hard to say there's an isser of belief because it's not something you can control, it's not totally true. We can impact the way we think about things, we can reserve judgment, and we can have a broader perspective. You don't control it the same way, like I say, don't turn on a light on Shabbos, don't turn it on, don't turn it off. Okay, those things are distinct actions you can relate to. So what you believe and what you don't believe about somebody is not as easily manipulated, but we can have some impact on how we process information and how we reserve judgment, and that's presumably a big part of what the Pasuk is saying. Okay, so to try to quickly, there's so much more to say, so just to quickly look at the other Pasukim, so the next Pasuk is actually very hard to translate. And it says, Losi Acher Rabim L'Ros, Losan El Riv Lintos, Acher Rabim L'Hatos. So Rashi already alludes to the fact that it's very hard to know what is going on here in this pasuk. There's a lot going on, a lot about Rov, that by the end of the pasuk is presumably telling us about the din of Rov, Acherav and Lahatos, that for purposes of dinim daraisa, we do follow the notion of majority, when there's all different kinds of Rov, some of them are effective daraisa, some aren't, but at least there's a notion of Rov daraisa that comes from this pasuk. and it has many, many nafkaminas, but at the beginning of the pasuk is telling you sometimes you shouldn't follow the rabbim. So if they're going to do something wrong, so then you shouldn't follow them, and you shouldn't go along with it. A lot of different interpretations seem perhaps repetitive in saying, we'll see acharav l'ravs, l'sanna, l'riv lintos acharav. So the Lev of Ram suggests that the double language there is that sometimes you're trying to win over people for the side of righteousness, so then maybe you're going to use false arguments in order to get it because you feel that the ends justify the means. He says you have two separate concepts here. You shouldn't follow the bad guys, and you shouldn't use bad arguments to try to win them over to the right side. And there's a lot of different aspects that emerge from this idea. Also, Chazal understand that it refers to Chiyuvei Misa, and that you can't follow just a bare minority of just one dying. You have to have at least two, which means you have to have a Bezdin that factors it in. It's how you get the notion of 23 Dayanim. So various ideas as far as what's going on here. There's a fascinating comment of the Orach Chaim here that brings up an issue, which is commenting on something that's itself fascinating, and I had talked about this on a panel a few years ago, one of a YU program that was run downtown, and I was on a panel with a lawyer, and the issue came up about jury nullification. Is it ethical for a lawyer to try to argue to a jury that even though you may think that the defendant is guilty, but you should decide for some other larger reason to let him off? So came up, is there a parallel in halacha? And I mentioned this discussion, which builds on another fascinating idea. There is a din, the Gemara says, according to most Rishonim, the Uri understands it differently, but according to most Rishonim, there's a din the Gemara has in Sanhedrin, a very counterintuitive din, that if you have a Bezdin, if you have a Sanhedrin that is unanimous, so in America, you need a unanimous jury to convict. But in halacha, if you have a unanimous Sanhedrin that decides somebody is Chayiv Misa, so the Gemara says, potrinoso, that we excuse him, we leave him to go free, and that if it's unanimous, there's something wrong. So Justice Scalia liked quoting this Gemara and saying this is a uniquely Jewish concept, the idea that somehow everybody is saying the same thing, there's got to be something wrong. If you're unanimous, then you've got to be missing something. And there's a lot to say about what this din reflects, and that's for a different time. But the Orach Chaim thought that it's relevant here because maybe you might think like this. So maybe you're on a Sanhedrin, and you decide somebody's totally guilty. But you realize that everyone else is also convinced he's totally guilty, and that if they all vote that way, so then he's going to go free. So maybe you should say that even though I believe he's guilty, I'm going to vote innocent, because that way he'll come out to be executed. So in other words, are you allowed to vote falsely in order to bring about what you believe will be the better result? So it's a type of justice, the jury nullification. So that's a discussion in Poskim in general, whether that's acceptable. Can you manipulate the vote in order to have the right result come out, even though it doesn't reflect what you actually think? So the Orach Chaim says from this pasuk, no, that's what it's talking about, that you're not allowed to say something false, even if you think that it's going to bring about a good result. So there's so much more to say, which is about out of time, just to rush through these psukim. So V'dalo said that the Rivo, you also shouldn't decide that you're going to favor somebody because they're poor. You have to stick to the truth. And here, Kisitka Shor Yidicha, O Chamoro Kowa Hashem Tishivanulam. So you have to return the lost animal, even of somebody who is your enemy. And to continue that theme, Kisira Chamor Soneacha, Robes Tachas Masov, Chavalta Mazoglo, Azov Tazov Yimo. You see an animal that's struggling and it belongs to your Sone, belongs to somebody you hate, so you have to help him. Tino Ufrika, you have to help him unload. So both of these ideas are interesting, the Hashavas Aveda obligation and the Tino Frika obligation of somebody specifically identified as your enemy. And the Gemara says here that how could you have a hated person? Isn't that a problem? So the Gemara says that this is here, Kidei Lachov as Yitzro, the Lachov is the Sinna, that by helping him, you will come to counteract that hatred. And that's a fascinating idea. Much later, Ben Franklin named that after himself, or he talked about this, and it was known as the Ben Franklin effect, that if you want to win somebody over, so if you get them to do a chesed for you, it's a way of creating some kind of a bond, that they'll feel more favorably to you. So apparently that's what the Torah is describing here, that if you have animosity towards somebody, but you act with chesed towards them, so that will make you feel better about them. And even though the Gemara suggests that there maybe it's a justified hatred, maybe the person is a bala vera, and nonetheless, there's still a need to try to conquer that. And the Balatanya has the comment based on this, that there's a whole distinction between hitting the sin and hitting the sinner. Tosfos had made a distinction between a somewhat surface sinna and a sinna gemura, that even if somebody acts in an inappropriate way, you're not supposed to like that. You have to recognize the person underneath. One shouldn't have an actual hatred towards. And whether that's the interpretation, it's a different interpretation, but it's a fascinating idea that the Gemara understands from this pasuk that specifically one should prioritize doing chesed to somebody has issues with, because that will come to soften that situation. And some suggest, one of the Svarim writes, that the idea that we say Aniya Ircha Kogmim, that we have a priority to give staka to those who are closest to us, is suggested it's related to this. I think in the Sefer L'Reacha Kamochi has that idea that it's related to this also, that we see from Chazal that when you do chesed to people, it also helps the relationship. It also creates a greater bond of friendship. So therefore, it makes sense that Aniya Ircha Kogmim, that you want to extend your chesed specifically to the people you interact with, because that's going to impact on the nature of that interaction, and that's something that will have a very important effect. A fascinating idea. And also this idea of azov tazov, which we understand to mean to help, but some suggest also together with this notion of hatred, it means that you have to leave the hatred. You have to be able to see past it in this moment when somebody needs chesed. And even if they're a sinful person, and maybe they'll do tshuva later, but right now they clearly haven't. And nonetheless, you have to get past that. You have to be able to extend that chesed anyway, and that's a part of the powerful message here. So a lot more to say. There's also Parshas Shkalim. Maybe we talk about the Galat Parshu. We might say about Shkalim also. Parshu is almost so much time. So I will wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, and there's a lot to think about as you go over the Shabbatim and Shkalim and try to ponder these various things. You have a tremendous impact. Okay, who is going?